Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. From time to time, we like to give you the opportunity to talk with experts in various fields, from personal finance to lawn and garden care and beyond. And today, we welcome your questions about children's health. Our guest is Dr. Malcolm Hill, pediatrician from Carle Physicians Group in Urbana. Dr. Hill can respond to a wide range of concerns, anything from vaccinations, common childhood illnesses, coping with minor bumps and bruises. Really, any kind of problem that you might discuss with your own family doctor is welcome today. Dr. Hill, welcome back to Focus.
Thank you. Good morning.
Glad to have you back with us.
Thank you.
I guess we were going to lead off with whooping cough, and we'll get to that,
yes.
But maybe we should also lead off with hearing, because you had the sad experience of putting on the headphones that I was wearing last, and I had them cranked up pretty high. I guess that's something we shouldn't do.
I would agree.
Yeah.
Kids and their headsets and buds and things really can damage the ears if the volume's up.
Are earbuds any more of an issue than sort of like padded headphones like you and I have on right
now? I really don't know. I think anything that produces sound where I can hear it when I'm watching you, if you have the earbuds, it's probably too loud and can damage the ears. So that's kind of one of the things that I would look at if I'm looking at my kids is, can I hear it when I'm sitting next to you? And it's probably too loud.
All right.
There's potential.
I'm going to turn my speaker down just a little bit
right now
so you can't hear it through my headphones. To speak with Dr. Hill, please call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on our Facebook page at Will Radio TV Online. Or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. All right, so whooping cough. This is high on lots of people's minds. What's going on with whooping cough?
There is a buzz about whooping cough right now. So, and what happens is someone comes in with a cough. It's been going on for more than a couple of weeks. Somebody has suspicion that it might be pertussis, which is whooping cough. So they do a swab or a nasopharyngeal swab and send it to the lab, and it comes back Bordetella pertussis. And so there's an index case. So that gets reported. And then, if they're in school, the school makes an announcement. And then physicians basically get the message. And then before long, we're checking lots of people for whooping cough. And without it, that index case that got reported, this may not have even been an issue, which is interesting because in the past, whooping cough has been very serious, a frequent problem, and I'll cover that a little bit. I hate to be didactic about it, but I'll cover some information on it, maybe answer a lot of questions, and then maybe we could get to some questions. But so whooping cough is also called pertussis, and it's caused by a bacteria, Bordetella pertussis. So it actually can spread from person to person. And before the This is really important. Before the pertussis vaccine, which we have, there were 200,000 to 300,000 cases a year in the United States. Now, 1,000 cases, 2,000 cases, until recently has been typical. So it's been a very treatable problem in the treatment's prevention. And so what is happening is that the bacteria itself infects the respiratory tract. And the toxin it's from the bacteria is what's causing most of the problem. The toxin damages the respiratory epithelium, cilia that clear your mucus, and therefore things build up and you get this terrible cough. So it's really not the bacteria, but the toxin. So our immunizations actually target the toxin that's produced. It comes in a stage. So the first stage is stage one, which is just basically a cold.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that after a week or two, the cold turns into a more severe cough, and it may come into what's paroxysmal stage, where the cough is episodic, severe, may cause vomiting. In young kids that have been immunized, they definitely get like a whoop, so they'll cough almost to the point of being totally blue and then do a big whoop at the end. So
wow.
It's pretty scary. I've seen several kids had not been immunized with whooping cough, and I really almost panicked in the office. It was so severe. Clearly, that's what it was. So the paroxysmal stage or the whooping cough stage is milder in people that are immunized. So matter of fact, it just may be a cough that's episodic through the day, maybe wakes you at night. but not as severe. You're not going to land in the hospital with that. Babies become very ill and often are in the hospital. So if you take someone that has a cough more than 3 or 4 weeks, immunizations are waning, there's a good chance, 10 to 20% chance that's whooping cough. So we still see it. It's just it's milder in the older folks, teenagers, and the people that have been immunized. So that's an important thing to know. So the complications are what we really run into with people, especially babies or immunized folks, pneumonia, encephalitis, seizures, broken ribs. We saw one adult exposed to whooping cough who had a cough for like 3 months and actually was cracking ribs. So, you know, it can be pretty uncomfortable in adults.
Why is it that it seems, I guess, this year we've heard of more cases reported here in Illinois? What is the reason for the uptick?
Well, there's two possibilities. The first is that we've had an uptick in the amount of whooping cough, and I can cover that a little too, is, the again, reporting and testing.
We're just testing more, and so we're finding the cases that may have always been there, or are they over, or are there false positives?
Probably, no false positives, probably, but probably both things are happening. First of all, a lot of the pediatricians, physicians are hearing that we're seeing more whooping cough, so we're testing more. A doctor at Vanderbilt did a nice study where she took all the people that were 12 and older that had been coughing more than 3 weeks and swabbed them from whooping cough, and 30% had whooping cough. So there's a higher index of suspicion. But what's happening also is that our immunizations have changed. So in the 1940s and 50s, when we first started seeing these vaccines come out, they were whole cell vaccines for whooping cough. So they took the pertussis bug and they just ground it up, injected it, and we had lots of components. That was a great vaccine. It worked well, but a lot of fever, local tenderness. So of 1990-ish, 91, they came out with these acellular vaccines where they just took 3 or 4 components, not the whole pertussis bug, and injected that for the vaccines. And that's what we have now. And what we're finding is that vaccine works pretty well in the first 5 years for infants. But at around age 5 to 10 years of age, the immunity wanes. So the kids, the real spike in the whooping cough has been kids 11, 12, 13 and older. And that's because the vaccine has just kind of waned in terms of its effectiveness. So we're giving boosters now to those 10, 11-year-olds, and also adults now are getting a pertussis vaccine. And in the past, that has not been true. So we're probably going to find we're going to have to immunize more frequently, immunize adults, and that's probably the issue. Increased awareness as well as the vaccines kind of had a little faltering.
What sort of impact does it have on you and other pediatricians if you have lots and lots of parents coming in saying, my kid coughed the other day, it's got to be whooping cough? That sort of.
Well, I'm hoping today we can kind of clear up some of those misconceptions. I mean, I think it, for me to tell whether it's whooping cough, if you've had a cold for a week, is impossible. But somebody comes in today, a couple of people came in today from Muhammad, and they've had a cough for over 3 weeks. You know, they may have been exposed. Those people probably need to be tested. Some kids should be treated as well.
How contagious is something like that?
Pretty contagious. If you're coughing a lot, if you see some of these kids coughing, it's spread by droplets, you know, through the air into the respiratory system. So if they're coughing and you're sitting next to them and, you know, in the classroom or certainly at home, you know, in terms of a real contact, there's probably, some people say, 70% chance of spreading it to the other individuals in the family.
If I can diverge for just a second, this is a question that has just always been in my mind. How is it that you and every other pediatrician on the face of the earth are not sick all the time?
Well,
I did get my
whooping cough booster.
Okay.
I did get that. I get my influenza vaccine every year. I don't stand in front of kids and adults that are coughing. Wash my hands 200 times a day till they, you know, my skin is basically falling off my fingers. So that's, you know, kind of that's what you do. Hopefully people will cover their cough into their sleeve. You know, I think if you're out and about, wash your hands. I think things like keyboards, phones, doorknobs are just loaded with you know, viruses and things.
So pretty much everything that I have been touching over the last hour.
You bet. I'm not going to touch it.
All right. Wonderful. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and our guest today is Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician from Carle Physicians Group in Urbana. Dr. Hill can respond to a wide range of concerns, anything from vaccinations and common childhood illnesses to coping with minor bumps and bruises. Any sort of problem that you might discuss with your own family doctor is welcome this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. Those phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. So beyond vaccination, beyond that booster, what else can you do to protect yourself against whooping cough? And then we can sort of set that aside.
You know, I think vaccination is incredibly important. I mean, look at the statistics, 200,000 to 300,000 people a year before the vaccine. And I think that's just critical. If you haven't been vaccinated, just beware. And I think other than avoiding people that are coughing, you know, if you see someone's coughing, if you can avoid the droplets, I don't know of any other great way to prevent. Now, schools and daycares, you know, what are you going to do? Kids are packed in pretty tight. And that's why I think there's, you know, more illnesses. It's not just winter. It's the kids are packed into school. They don't get out as much. It's, you know, face-to-face. You know, three feet apart would be nice, but that's not going to happen. And
yeah,
there's a lot of touching that goes on, you know. So I'm not sure there's a whole lot else that you can do. If you do get exposed to somebody that, with no whooping cough, though, there is a treatment. An antibiotic does kill the bacteria. So if you get to the bacteria before it causes that whoop or that really paroxysm of cough, you may be able to really short-circuit the whole process.
Let's take a call. We have Brenda on the line from Champaign. Good morning, Brenda.
Hi, good morning, Dr. Hill.
Good morning.
Our son was a patient of yours, but he's now 25, and he's very concerned about vaccinations in general. What can you say about why people are concerned about vaccinations and why should they not be concerned? Mm. And I'll take your answer off the air.
Hey, good morning. Hi. Hope your son's doing well.
He's great.
Good.
Thanks.
Good. I think, first of all, I think the web, World Wide Web, is a beautiful tool, but there's so much information out there, and there's a lot of misinformation about all sorts of things, including vaccines. And there are some actual physicians that are well-known. I won't mention any names, but that they also have had their concerns and publish a lot and things of this sort. Then there are TV stars and radio folks that get on the air and do their song and dance without, you know, any background. So if I was a person out there, I would certainly, if I was listening to this, I would be concerned as well. So if a concerned person should probably go to valid sources where there's statistical information like the Center for Disease Control, National Institute of Health, and look at data on this stuff because there's lots of data on it. I mean, I mentioned the whooping cough, you know, and the vaccine and the impact we had on that. So, you know, I think you've got to look at the statistics. Some people will never be comfortable, and I understand that. I also think there's a basic distrust of physicians, pharmaceutical companies that seems to be surfacing. I don't know if people would agree. I don't know if you guys would agree with that or not. But there seems some of that, too. And I think it's been, you know, things have happened. So then there's insurance companies and all the other things that are happening in medicine now. So some of it's trust, too. But as a pediatrician, I'm going to try to keep up with the literature. I'm going to try to keep up with the science. And if I think this looks like a good deal, I'm going to recommend it. So far, I haven't really, as far as recommending, I haven't had much reservation. I would say I grew up when I saw kids with polio and adults with polio. I don't see polio now. When I was a resident in the first 10 years in practice, I treated kids with meningitis who were severely affected, deaf, you know, seizures, neurologic impairment. We started vaccinating with the Prevnar vaccine, HIV vaccine, for the most common causes of bacterial meningitis in the first year of life, and I haven't seen a case in years. So I'm in favor. And then the influenza vaccine is another one that is pretty important, too, which you know, some people don't think it's important, but look at the statistics on the deaths per year from influenza. And with the vaccine that we have, there's still 36,000 deaths a year from influenza, typically, depending upon the strain. So, and it was way higher than that before we started immunizing everybody. So,
I want to talk a little bit about the flu and cold versus flu and some other things in a bit. But before we leave behind the topic of immunization, we have this comment from Kathleen, who wants you to talk about the value of community immunity, especially for people who are around babies, pregnant mm-hmm. women, and those with compromised mm-hmm. immunity.
Hey, pregnancy, I forgot about that. So with, can I just divert a little bit here?
Sure.
So now they're recommending that pregnant women receive the whooping cough vaccine with tetanus vaccine. It's called DTaP. So that is actually a good, effective way of providing the baby with immunity before the baby's even born, because the antibodies pass over from mom to the fetus. So that's really an excellent one. And the question again relates to...
Kathleen says, I'd like you to talk about the value of mm-hmm. community immunity, yeah. especially for people who are around babies, pregnant women, and those with compromised immunity.
Yep, excellent. I agree with that fully. Because, you know, I think some infants are too young to be immunized for influenza. So, yes, we recommend that families be immunized. We recommend that families be immunized for the whooping cough vaccine because babies are very susceptible to whooping cough. And there's something called herd immunity. So what we found is interesting. When we started using this HIV vaccine, we started immunizing kids 2 and older for meningitis because it was approved for those kids, not for kids younger. And when we did that, we found that, guess what? Even the younger kids had a reduced incidence of Haemophilus meningitis because the siblings were immunized. So there's a herd immunity that exists. And so, I mean, classic example is eradication of smallpox. You know, we've eradicated it. Immunizing for measles. So we're not seeing measles now, and we're protecting people that aren't immunized to some degree because we're providing, you know, kind of a protection zone for them. But that's not always perfect because people will come in from other countries with measles or chickenpox or some of these diseases, and they land here, and if you haven't been vaccinated, you're at risk.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician from Carle Physicians Group in Urbana, and he's here to field your questions about children's health. And he can respond to all sorts of concerns that you may have. Anything you might discuss with your own family doctor is welcome during this hour. And while I am happy to continue to ask questions of Dr. Hill, really this hour is for you. So I do encourage you to call in with your questions now at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Of course, we also welcome questions on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Dr. Hill, tell you what, let's put on hold the discussion about cold versus flu, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. But in the meantime, I want to remind you that we are entering the home stretch of a brief year-end fundraising campaign here at WILL, in which we are seeking to raise $36,000 in just 36 hours of fundraising. This is your opportunity to support the in-depth news and thoughtful analysis that you hear every day right here on WILL. And we have a different phone number for you to call in order to do that. And that is 217-244-9455. That's 217-244-9455. Help to ensure the future of programs like Focus and all of the work that we do here at WILL every day to bring you news and information that is factual, that offers context and clarity about the issues, the ideas that affect all of us. And to talk some more about the importance of your contribution right now, I'm joined by Lisa Braltz. Hi, Lisa.
Good morning.
Glad to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
And so we are working our way towards some important goals during this campaign. I mentioned that dollar goal, but the bottom line is to sort of stay on pace towards that overall goal for the campaign.
That's right. And so far in this abbreviated campaign, as you mentioned, we're actually using a hashtag on Twitter, speaking of Twitter, which is the pound sign or the hashtag, mm-hmm. 36 hours to 36,000. So that's our goal is to keep it short and get to $36,000 and beyond in that short time frame. And so far we've heard from 103 donors.
Great.
in this abbreviated drive, and we've raised over $20,000 so far.
That's fantastic.
So yes, it is fantastic, but really, we can do better. I know we can do more than that. So as Craig mentioned, our number is 217-244-9455. You can also give online at willpledge.org. That's really super easy if you can't get to a telephone or you're surfing the web and you don't feel like going to the phone. Our internet site is a really easy way to do that.
We are committed to in-depth, thoughtful news and information, providing stories that offer depth and context, details beyond which you might hear on other radio stations or in other media outlets. And we think that that's something that's pretty important, and we're committed to it.
This is a premier morning program. I mean, this really is one of the many jewels in the crown here at WILL, and particularly AM 580. I mean, just having a local physician coming in and providing some context to a current situation about, you know, illness. It's the season, and just giving that advice, taking questions from people, comments from online. That interactivity is really special, and it's something that we do best. I mean, it's really important. So we know that we have lots and lots of listeners in the area, but only 10% of those listeners end up joining us. And, you know, if this is something that you believe in and you appreciate, your support would be most welcome at this time.
I have to say that one of the first things we talked about as we were in the process of sort of relaunching Focus this fall was the idea that every month we devote at least one show to something dealing with our personal health. So one month we might have Dr. Hill on to talk about children's health. The next month we might have someone on to talk about women's health, another to talk about general health for all of us. But that idea, we've been able to hold to that so far, and I hope we can continue to do so, because I think it's such an important topic and something that people always have questions about. You know, not just a cough or a cold, but what's that thing growing on my hand?
Well,
I mean, all sorts of possibilities.
Well, it is really comforting as a listener, I think, when these programs come on to know, if somebody has a real concern, they should go to their own doctor and not just listen to the radio hoping for a solution. But as a listener, listening to the pediatricians talk about children when my children were much younger, I really listened to these programs quite closely, not just to sort of soothe my own mind or conscience about what was going on with them, but to find out what was going on in the community with kids. They're out there. They know exactly what's going on. And same with the other physicians, too. And so I really think that local context is something that's incredibly valuable. And again, like I said, it's something that we do so well. And I just want to report, too, not to change the subject about how awesome our programs are, but Pledge producer Heather Miller just let me know that we've heard from 105 donors. So we've
Excellent.
Heard from a couple people already this hour. We know we can hear from at least, let's say three more in this last half hour. I would love to hear from at least three people. So give us a call, 217-244-9455, or give online at willpledge.org.
We have a member match going on right now. When you call in your pledge, your gift will be matched with a $36 contribution from a pool of money raised by current donors, current friends of WILL, who want to make sure that we have a successful $36,000 in 36 hours. You said it more clearly than I have been saying it.
36 hours to $36,000.
36
and
hours.
Beyond.
It's a great idea for a campaign, and they're adding $36 for every contribution. So you can make your dollars go further, whether you get $50 or $1,000 or all points in between. The amount is up to you. But the idea of making that contribution, that's why current friends of WILL are stepping up, because they want to encourage as many people as possible to come on board and become friends of WILL. That phone number again is 217-244-9455.
That's right. Membership, definitely has its benefits. We have for the very most basic membership that we have at $40, all of our members receive the Patterns magazine, which have our program schedules, not just for radio, but also for television, articles that provide a little more detail about some of the programs that you hear or see, special events that WILL holds for both its radio and TV programs. So even at that level, we would love to get new members. I mean, that's one thing that we're really looking for. We're also looking for sustaining members, people who contribute the same amount of money every month that's coming directly out of a bank account or payroll deduction, so that you don't ever have to think about it. Your membership is always current. Those sustaining donors are also really important to what we do. So in these drives, we're looking for new members, we're looking for sustainers, and we're looking for renewals. Sometimes a year or two goes by and you your membership lapses, you might forget, things get busy. Now is a really great time to renew that membership too. So if you give us a call at 217-244-9455 or give online at willpledge.org, you have the opportunity to become a new member, a sustaining member, or a renewed member.
All right, Lisa, thanks very much, and we'll check back with you in a little while.
Super, thank you.
And let me just give out that number one more time, 217-244-9455 is the number to call to make your contribution in support of WILL. The numbers to call to join us on air today, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 to talk with Dr. Malcolm Hill, pediatrician from Carle Physicians Group in Urbana, and we will talk some more with him after a short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from Amisong, Champaign-Urbana's premier lesbian feminist chorus, with their annual winter concert on December 15th and 16th at McKinley Presbyterian Church, 809 South 5th in Champaign. Supported in part by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, a state agency. Details at amisong.org.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're taking your questions today on children's health for pediatrician Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's from Carle Physicians Group in Urbana, and he can address pretty much anything you might discuss with your own family doctor. That includes common childhood illnesses, cold and flu season, vaccinations, minor bumps and bruises, whatever may be on your mind about a child in your life. Give us a call at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Dr. Hill, as we were talking about, flu season is very much upon us. How do you know whether you got the flu or you've got a cold?
Good question. Yeah, I think they're seeing flu now, and it's a little early. So we may have a early flu season, and it may be more severe than in the past because of the strains. So influenza virus, you know, is it like a? It's like a cold. It's a virus, but it's just more potent. Basically, higher fever, longer duration. Cough is more intense, more body aches, more sore throat. Some people are kind of, at least I was when I was, before I was in medical school, was confused with flu, considering that a gastrointestinal infection. The influenza, which we call flu, is actually a respiratory infection. There may be some GI complaints, but the primary thing is the respiratory tract, the nose, mm-hmm. throat, chest. And so it hits you like a brick, you know, basically. It's not like, I think I have a cold.
What once you have a sense that you have the flu, is that you have to kind of go quickly to the doctor? What do you recommend? How quickly do you come to that conclusion?
Well, of course, I would recommend getting a flu vaccine. Anybody right. over 6 months, for two reasons. One is it's a miserable illness. You miss school or work for a week at least. You spread it to other people, especially old folks like me or young folks under two, which are at highest risk for complications, which are really, you know, the pneumonias and encephalitis right. and things. If you are a healthy person and you think you had the flu and you've had your vaccine or not, typically treating the symptoms is what we do, not necessarily anything specific. If you have a health problem, diabetes or asthma or seizures or you're old or very young, then there is medication. If you take it in the first couple of days of influenza, you can reduce the symptoms and potentially reduce complications. So, you know, I think obviously prevention first. If you're at risk and think you have influenza, call your doc and see if you're, you know, really not eligible, but see if treatment would be recommended.
All right. So let's take this from the standpoint of a parent of a young child. Child develops a cold, mm-hmm. got the flu vaccine, but whatever, there's something going on, and all of a sudden a fever starts. Okay. At what point do you say, okay, we got to go to the doctor? This is more than just mm-hmm. your average sniffle.
So fever's not uncommon, even with, you know, the non-flu viruses. In the first two or three days, it's actually really common. So we don't necessarily ask people to come in the first two or three days. A fever, fever begins with the initial respiratory infection. What I'd be more concerned about is a child who's had a respiratory infection for 3 or 4 days, 5 days, all of a sudden develops a fever, maybe ear pain, sore throat, or increased cough, and those kids probably should be evaluated. with influenza, the problem is the duration of fever. So a lot of times what will happen is if you do see a child with influenza, they'll have a fever 101 to 104 for 2 or 3 days. And after about the third day, everybody's getting worried. So a lot of times they do come in. We take a look at their ears, listen to their lungs, and make sure there are no complications.
Is this an old wives' tale, or is it true that kids can develop more severe fevers and it can be less dangerous than for adults with the same kind of level of fever?
I think kids have higher fever. Yeah, I'm not sure it's any more or less dangerous, but kids tend to run fever more often than adults with the same infection.
Why is that?
I have no idea.
Well,
I just see it.
Appreciate the honesty.
Also at night. Temperature goes up at night, so a lot of the fever calls start around 5 o'clock. One thing I forgot to mention about influenza is that if you're taking aspirin products, then you really are at risk for RISE syndrome. So that would be important to know as well. If you do take aspirin for whatever reason and you're a young, you know, a teenager or child.
What is RISE syndrome?
Oh, something you don't see much anymore, but it's kind of a metabolic illness that begins usually after you've had influenza or chickenpox. Mm-hmm. And if you've been on aspirin, and it causes liver damage and encephalopathy, where your brain swells, and it's very, very, it's life-threatening most of the time. Mm. We used to see a lot of that in the, in the 70s and 80s before we figured that aspirin was probably the associating factor. So now if you ask a pediatrician about, you know, pain or fever control, they're saying acetaminophen or ibuprofen, not aspirin. We use aspirin for selected problems, but not typically.
Since you mentioned acetaminophen and aspirin and, you know, whether ibuprofen, what to use and what not to use. But do you have any particular strong opinions about various cold remedies, over-the-counter medication, what you should use and under what circumstances for kids?
I'd say most cold and cough medications don't work, and they've actually taken them off the shelf for kids under two. So I'm not a big fan of them. I think chicken soup, fluids, proper humidity, you know, humidified air, rest. You know, I think that's kind of where most of it is. Now, older folks and teenagers, sometimes they benefit from Sudafed, Sudafedrin for nasal congestion, and some ibuprofen or Tylenol for aches and pains. But short of that, I don't have a lot of interest in those medications. So
I like that chicken soup was first on your list.
It is. No, it really is.
Yeah.
I could tell you the story, but I won't.
Okay.
Well, actually, a pediatrician who's a researcher did a nice study on the immune system and following white cell function, and actually did some really scientific tests, and his grandmother's chicken soup definitely increased the white cell movements in a skin window, which is a diagnostic test. So he published that, which I found that hard to believe. But
why is
chicken
it?
Soup?
What is it about chicken soup?
Ask your grandmother. I don't know. Nutrition's important, isn't it?
Yeah. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Dr. Malcolm Hill, pediatrician from Carl Physicians Group in Urbana. He is here to field your questions about children's health, and he can respond to a wide range of concerns, anything from common childhood illnesses to vaccinations to coping with bumps and bruises to anything else that might be on your mind that you deal with if you have a child in your life, young child, teenager, pretty much from infancy through teenage years, you see pretty much everybody, right?
Yes, sir.
The phone number to call to talk with Dr. Hill is 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also send an email to will-talk@illinois.edu. Phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. We also wanted to talk a little bit about travel. I mean, we're closing in on that moment where a lot of families are going to hit the road, do that maybe one big vacation a year, maybe to warmer climes, maybe going skiing, I don't know, whatever it is that the people decide to do. There are a couple of issues that can come up if you have children in tow. One is if you're hitting the road with a kid who has a cold, mm-hmm. and how you deal with it and where you get treatment. And the other one is what happens if they get sick during the vacation and you're a long way from your pediatrician.
Well, I think, first of all, you can most of the time stay in contact with your pediatrician, whether you're on the road or not. And I think that's a good way of approaching most of the problems. Be prepared. I mean, if you have children with health problems, make sure you have extra medication, because in case things, you know, travel sometimes gets delayed. You know, I think if they're, you know, on the bubble, see your pediatrician or family physician before you leave. there's any issue. But most of the time it's just being prepared, having all the proper medications and things with you. History, you know your kid's history. I mean, I think most people do, what immunizations they've had, what kind of illnesses they've had. But a lot of times if people call us, if they're out of town, we can search their record pretty quickly and give information to emergency departments or things of that sort or other physicians. I think that's, you know, one thing for sure. One thing people forget about, too, is it's unfortunate, but check with your insurance company on travel. And
yeah,
if you get stuck somewhere, call them as well so that you don't get stuck with a big bill.
Oh, I imagine, you know, there are probably folks out there that think, well, no matter where I am, I can call my doctor, wherever he or she is, and get whatever prescription I might need called in. How do you know when the circumstance is appropriate for you to reach out to your doctor from a distance or to go see physically a doctor?
Well, how important is that? It would probably be the same as if you called my office, though. You know, yeah. I have an ailment. I would like medication. Well, I need to evaluate you.
Yeah.
I wish I could, but I think the point being you need to be evaluated. And if that's the case, you need to see somebody so that we can prescribe the correct medication as opposed to just calling in an antibiotic for a fever, you know, or something. So, and most people don't do that, honestly.
No.
They know.
Do you think I know there's been a debate for a number of years about how much kids should take in terms of antibiotics when they're sick and what impact that maybe has on whether they build up immunity to mm-hmm. certain antibiotics over time.
No, well, I think what happens is that if you take an antibiotic, you kill off bacteria. You only kill off the bacteria that are basically susceptible to that antibiotic. So what do you leave? You leave bacteria that can't be treated with an antibiotic that we usually use. So therefore, we have resistant bugs. And that's the problem with antibiotics, is we develop resistant bacteria out there. So the next time we're sick, it's not with the common bug. It's with a resistant bug that may be more difficult to treat.
So then there's not necessarily any reason to hold back from using antibiotics, provided they work.
Provided they're prescribed for a legitimate reason.
Right.
You know, for instance, there's a move to reduce the use of antibiotics with ear infections, and I think that's valid. Older kids recently be comfortable when they come in, they have an ear infection, the chances of them getting better are pretty great. Maybe we won't prescribe for that. What happened was over years, people prescribed antibiotics for colds and things of that sort, and that's where we ran into trouble. So there was a big push over the last 10 to 15 years of, you know, basic physicians don't use antibiotics in common problems that don't need them, and I think that's where, or sore throats without doing a strep screen, you still see that. So we don't do that.
Let's take some more calls. We'll go next to Melissa in Urbana. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. I have a 5-month-old infant, and I'm not sure about when I should start introducing solid foods. I'm hearing a lot of debate and hearing that the AAP is now recommending waiting to 6 months and maybe not starting with cereals but with fruits instead. I'm just sort of curious what the doctor thinks about that.
Well, I'm glad you're confused because I think most of us are. and thanks for that question. I didn't have that on my list. So nutrition's an interesting thing. It's starting to become a more, valid science. A lot of people doing research. A lot of people are looking at nutrition and when to introduce foods and things of this sort. And so what we know, basically, is that after 6 months, you can introduce food safely without really increased risk of food allergy or issues related to foods. And you could start with fruits, vegetables, cereal. There's no order. I think in the past, committees just came up with an order because they did the best they could. They came up with, 6 months, it was just the best information they had. Between 4 and 6 months, we don't have any evidence that there's a harm in introducing foods. Matter of fact, half the breastfed babies probably need additional calories at 4 months. And so you can carefully introduce foods at 4 months, best I can tell by the literature and by research. And I would just personally go slow. I say at four months, I would probably only pick a couple of foods to introduce between 4 and 6 months, but that's my opinion. And I would look for, problems, but I think most kids can tolerate. They actually recently just looked at iron storage and hemoglobins in breastfed babies, and they looked at kids that were that had foods introduced at 4 months and 6 months, and actually the kids that had the complementary foods offered at 4 months had a little higher hemoglobin and iron storage. So, you know, there may be some changes in recommendations, and committees do the best they can, and so it is, we're in transition. There's really one interesting piece of work going on in Chicago. A gastroenterologist there at one of the children's hospitals is looking at whether if we introduce wheat early, gluten basically, at 2, 4, and 6 weeks of age, whether we can actually prevent celiac disease, which is actually due to a intolerance to wheat or gluten. Hmm. So we may be all wrong with this. When I first was in pediatric residency, some doctors had a very interesting diet where at 2 weeks you started this food, and at 4 weeks, and it was early introduction to foods that basically was being taught to the pediatricians. And we moved away from that. And interestingly enough, the incidence of food allergies has gone way up, best we can tell. So it's interesting. So I think 4 months is, getting back to your question, 4 months is perfectly legitimate time to start supplementary foods. I hope that answered your question.
Yes, thank you.
All right, thanks very much for the call, Melissa. Let's go next to Bruce in Champaign. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning. Good morning. I have no children. I'm not a child. I'm 65. I'm getting ready. I'm asking a question about whether or not flu vaccines are regional. I'm in Champaign now. I'm going to be in Arizona, southern Arizona, in about a week. Should I get a flu shot here or wait till I get there because the temperature and climate is so different?
That's a good question. So the flu vaccine is not regional. It's pretty much standardized throughout the country and actually throughout this hemisphere. So it has two versions of the A influenza and one of B. And luckily, we're 90% on. So 90% of the cases of influenza so far have been covered by the vaccine. So I would get your vaccine here for sure. Okay. And then I think you may be eligible for pneumococcal vaccine, too. You might check with your doctor on that. So
okay.
Thanks for
that
question.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question. I wanted to ask, you know, we started to talk about travel. And there's one thing, which is hitting the road in the car. You know, you can stop somewhere. You can go to a hospital, a doctor's office. What about kids in flight? Are there times when certain things that you should think about if you think your kid's got, I mean, you mentioned ear infections earlier, and that occurred to me. I thought, I'll bet that could just be nasty for flying. What are some things you should think about before you step on a plane with a child that may be sick?
Well, the first thing is I just was traveling recently, and my four-hour flight turned into 12 hours. So there's often delays. Airlines do all sorts of interesting things now with flights. And so you've got to really be prepared for long delays, sometimes over 24 hours you're getting laid over, especially if the weather is a problem. So again, be prepared with your foods, diapers, medications, whatever you need there, and be patient because it can be a long, long day.
Right.
You know, when you're traveling on the plane, I mean, I think it's a, you know, generally safe way to travel, much safer than an automobile. I think strapped in would be the first thing. If you're not really up and about, keep yourself buckled up for, you know, the turbulence and things that happen. If you've got a baby and you don't have their own seat or car seat, then on your lap, buckled up.
Well, I guess what I'm wondering is if there are certain common childhood maladies where you say, you know what, if you even are showing signs of that, you shouldn't even step on the plane.
Well, I mean, if you want to be really I think cognizant of other people's health, then if you've got a kid that has a fever and coughing and is sick, you know, you're spreading that to the entire airplane, you know, the entire occupants of the airplane. So, I mean, that's just, you know, hopefully good common sense. Ear infections, you know, if you have an ear infection that's acute and you've got a kid that's in significant pain, you shouldn't be flying anyway. But once they get treated and they're comfortable, you fly. It's a, you know, the pressurized cabins, you do the best you can with those. I don't know of any special tricks. You know, decongestants aren't going to make a bit of difference. Benadryl and some things of that sort, medications for kids are not going to help. For adults, it's a different population. But it it's been shown not to be effective. So maybe some Tylenol, ibuprofen with you, you know, and get on the ground, you know.
We have just a minute or so left, and I was curious if you have any specific tips or anything that you mention to parents of kids going into the winter months in terms of keeping an eye on appropriate diet and exercise, just basic general well-being. What are some of the things that you try and remind parents to think about?
Basically, I think, you know, nutrition's a year-round issue. It looks like multivitamins are going to be kind of the general recommendation, primarily for vitamin D, but, you know, kids' diets aren't perfect. Drinking plenty of fluids through the day is important for your health as well.
But especially with kids inside a lot more, maybe not exercising as much, what else should they be thinking about?
Well, TV, screen time, those, we talked about this before, but I think you've got to, you know, hey, it's winter, but dress and get out, you know, dress for the occasion, get out and play. I think there's no reason. Organized sports are always nice if you can fit in some organized sports, but it's not always possible for people. Hopefully we'll get bus service to the Y.
Yep.
And get some kids out there that maybe otherwise wouldn't have a facility. So that's kind of a community issue, isn't it?
Yeah. So Dr. Malcolm Hill is a pediatrician with Carl Physicians Group. Dr. Hill, as always, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And in our final minutes, I want to remind you of the importance of your financial support to this public radio station. WILL is in the midst of closing in on the final hours of our 36-hour fundraising campaign to raise $36,000, during which time every gift that we receive, every contribution, at least right now, is matched with $36 from current donors. And the way you do that, the way you make this happen and ensure the future of the news and information and great services that we provide here is by calling 217-244-9455. You make a gift of maybe $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever amount is right for your budget. But do so now to help ensure the future of these programs, to make sure that we can pay the bills necessary to bring you next year's programs. 217-244-9455 is the phone number to call. Lisa Braltz is back with us. Lisa, what's the latest?
Here's the update. Pledge producer Heather Miller just keeps writing things on pieces of paper in front of me here. So we have a couple people that we'd like to thank. We'd like to shout out our thanks to Ann Spurgeon and Kevin and Nancy Lockman.
They have
gotten in touch with us during this hour. And as Craig said, those folks are putting us on our way to $36,000 in 36 hours of pledge time, of air time. And we're going through the end of the day today, and we'll be on the air tomorrow. And then it's over. It's done. It's a very abbreviated pledge drive to close out our not just December, but our year, our calendar year. So we've heard from 109 folks so far during this drive, and we've raised over $20,000 so far. So we are looking for more. We've got 7 minutes left in this hour, and we'd love to hear from a couple more folks. So give us a call, 217-244-9455, or you can go online and give at willpledge.org.
Might be worth the while to back up for just a minute and talk about the amount of money it takes to run this radio station, to provide the funds necessary to bring you the programs that you hear, including Focus and every other program that you hear on WILL. We have to raise over the course of our fundraising year about $2 million.
Just over
$2 million. So as we close it on the end of December, well, that's halfway through our fundraising year, which ends the end of June. What that means is we're at the halfway point, and we, of course, want to stay on pace. So our goal is to try and at least cross over the $1 million threshold. And we are apparently very, very close to
that. We're getting there. Yes,
we
are definitely
excellent.
Getting there.
And so that's why we have this campaign to raise $36,000, which will get us then that much closer. And I think then it's just a question of maybe, you know, another, I don't know, $10,000, $20,000, something like that comes in off the air in through various other fundraising endeavors, and we will have crossed that $1 million mark. So that's why we've set that campaign goal. It's 36 hours, $36,000. You do the math, you realize, well, to stay on pace, we want to raise about $1,000 an hour. We've been able to do that so far. But I did notice that things dropped off just a little bit this morning. And so it's important that we don't fall behind on that pace. We had a great day yesterday. We can still have a great day today. But we really do count on your contribution to help us. You know, we raise $1,000 this hour, then $1,000 the next hour. And that's the way it works. So I hope you'll call 244-9455. That's 217-244-9455. 9455 to make that contribution to help us stay on pace towards these important goals.
And Craig, just since you started talking, two more people have gotten in touch with us.
Excellent.
So this is wonderful. Thank you so much to those folks who have gotten in touch with us, not just in the last hour, but during this drive too. And I did want to mention, you know, I think a lot of folks think because we are an NPR station that those programs, we automatically have access to those programs just because we're a member. They just beam everything in. And actually, we're a member station, but we pay for each and every one of those programs that you're hearing, the national programs. Locally, too, it costs money for us to be on the radio. So your contributions are, you know, going toward this programming that you appreciate and that you love so much. And you know, 40% of our operating income is coming from our audience, or actually it's just a little more than 40%. So we really do rely on our listeners.
And that's our single largest source of funding.
Absolutely.
And it's our most reliable source as well. Other sources of funding for which we are very grateful, well, they ebb and flow, you might say.
Exactly.
And the one constant has been individual listeners stepping up. That combination of individual donors, your friends and neighbors pooling their resources together, that's what we can count on year after year. And, you know, somebody out there a year ago, 2 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, made contributions so that the programs that you're hearing today and that you have heard for years could be on this station. It's your responsibility then to pay it forward, to make a contribution today so that someone else, including you and everyone else, can enjoy these programs tomorrow and in the years to come.
I think that is a really important point, that the station that you're hearing today is the result of, it's like a cumulative result of all the pledging and the membership activity that's been going on before you, and you can be a part of this station's future. So also speaking of individual contributors, we'd also like to thank Matt Coventry for giving us a call.
Thank you, Matt.
So thank you so much. Anybody else, give us a call, 217-244-9455.
Lisa, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And that will do it for Focus. My thanks to our technical director. I also wanted to thank, our producer, Travis Stanzel, and our technical director, Kyle Mabry. I'm Craig Cohen.